Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to Mushing Radio here on KVRF 89.7 in the Mattsu Valley. RadioFreePalmer.org is our live streaming site. You can find all of our episodes over on DogWorksRadio.com, and make sure you check us out on social media. Calling in from Southern California is our co-host. His name is Alex Stein. Alex, how's it going?
It's going great, Robert. You know, it's for us here, and also for you in Alaska, it is kind of the middle of summer. It's a little bit unseasonably hot in a lot of places, but just 248 days from now, and a little bit of change as we're taping this, will be the start of Iditarod 2020.
I'm looking forward to it, and as you said, it is truly the dog days of summer up here in Alaska. It's been in the high 70s to the middle 80s, which is relatively warm up here. All of the stores around have sold out of air conditioners and fans, and people are just dying of heat up here, but it's nothing new to the rest of the country. They're used to the heat, aren't they?
They are, but, you know, it's although occasionally it will get up to the 70s and 80s in Alaska, it's very unusual to have this high heat and to have like prolonged spells of this much heat. And, you know, I read recently that they are expecting that Anchorage might break its all-time record for a record high. So while it might not seem like much for it to be in the you know, mid to high 80s, for Alaska, that's a pretty severe change from how it usually is, even in the height of summer.
That's right. And we have a lot to cover today. And since we're talking a little bit about the weather and how dry it is, I think we should first talk about the wildfires. And they're springing up all over in Alaska. And there's three fires in particular that we want to talk about. But the first one broke out in downtown Anchorage last night, not too far from where the ceremonial start for Iditarod ends, about 13 miles or so from where they go under the banner and all that downtown. And that really put a scare to a lot of people because it's a relatively populated area. But also, since it is so dry and we're having a real problem with bark beetles up here, all of the black spruce are just going up like tinder, and it's really scaring a lot of folks, isn't it, Alex?
It is, and there were evacuations ordered, which I think, as we're taping this, have been canceled, and I think that fire is relatively contained or shortly will be completely contained. But that's something that you really have to worry about, especially when it's been as dry as it has been. And, you know, we're heading into the big 4th of July holiday weekend. And in a lot of parts of Alaska, traditionally, there's sort of a, let's say, relatively open view of people setting off fireworks. And I know that there have been a bunch of restrictions in various areas where in years prior, it was fine to set off fireworks. And now the authorities are saying, well, no, you shouldn't do this. It's too dry, and there's too much stuff that fuel that could go up. So that's a little bit of a big difference for Alaska usually has kind of a laissez-faire attitude towards a lot of these things.
Right. And another fire that is worth mentioning is down on the Kenai Peninsula, and there are several mushers that live down there, but typically, it's quite a bit further south than where this fire is, up near Sterling, and that is the home of Mitch Seavey's kennel. I don't believe he is in any danger where he's at, but it's relatively close to where he's at. Is that right?
Yeah, and you know, I think that fire too is, if not well contained, is on its way to being well contained. But it is something that was of a lot of concern with people who are living down on the Kenai. And I think because of the wind patterns, that was the fire that was causing so much smoke and haze up in the Anchorage area as well.
That's right. That's right. And also, there's another big fire outside of Fairbanks, and this is of quite a bit of concern for mushers in that area. I know they have even called special meetings for animal control and all sorts of other things to talk about potential evacuations and all of that. And we bring this up on this show because 4 years ago, there was a huge fire right here, pretty much in our backyard here in Willow. And it is a huge ordeal to try to get out a sled dog kennel in any quick fashion. And I know there's quite a bit of talk on Facebook, on some of the mushing pages about, you know, emergency evacuation plans and what do you have in your kit and what happens if you're not there and where are the keys to the truck or the trailer and whatnot. So it is a big deal all around, I believe.
Yeah, absolutely. And Ali Zirkel had posted on Facebook a couple of days ago that that the fire is not of an immediate threat to them, but that they are all ready in case they need to go and evacuate their dogs. And as horrible as the fires were a couple of years ago, I think one of the silver linings in that is that a lot of mushers and a lot of people who run or help run kennels have realized that they need to have an emergency plan and an evacuation plan that they can put into service relatively quickly. And, you know, I've seen some people say that this has actually caused them to rethink their evacuation plans. But I think that the one good thing that has come out of all of the horrible fires, and certainly it seems like this is going to become the new normal in the coming years, is that people have really had to think about, what am I going to do if this fire comes too close to me, if this fire is threatening me and my family and my kennel, and how do I get everybody out safely, including all of the dogs? So, you know, as horrible as it is to contemplate these fires, I think the fact that people are being more proactive and are really thinking about what they would do if the fire affects them is a good thing.
Yeah, it took us 5 trucks and 2 trips to get all of our dogs and gear out when we evacuated for the Sockeye fire. And it was a feat of massive undertaking, and we could not have done it without other family and friends for sure. So I hope everybody works their way through this. I hope nobody loses their home and, of course, anything of any value. And we just hope that everything works out. I know you're used to fires down there in California. You have them every year. You have even a fire season down there. But it's relatively atypical up here, at least in terms of near populated areas, because, number one, we don't have a lot of lightning, and that is all of a sudden changed. I guess that's one of the new things with climate change is now we're seeing thunder and lightning up here in Alaska, and that is definitely a new phenomenon for sure. Alex, let's jump over and talk about the Iditarod signups. Just last weekend, as we're taping this, they had the annual Iditarod picnic. It is the first day of signups for the Iditarod as well as the Junior Iditarod. And it's really the kickoff to the Iditarod season. And I know we've talked a lot on this show about how other sports are now becoming yearly sports like the NFL or baseball or whatever, with a very busy offseason with you know, coverage on social media and cable and all of that. But now Iditarod does something very similar, and they have held for years this Iditarod sign-up and picnic. What can you tell us about the sign-ups as they stand right now?
So there were 40 people who signed up on the first day, and one who's come in since then, in the few days since then. But 40 is a very healthy number, I would say. Last year there were only 28, and last year when the race started, I believe there were 52 teams that set out. So we're already almost at that level. And the regular signups go on until December, and there are late signups that are possible even after that. So it looks like we're going to have a much bigger field than we had. The other piece of good news is that there are, in those 40 who signed up, there are, I believe, unless I miscounted, 7 rookies. And it's always a good sign when there are a healthy number of rookies, because they will go on to, become the veterans who will hopefully dominate and sustain the sport in coming years. We have, I think, four teams from Canada, team from Norway, and we have a team this year from Denmark, which is kind of unusual. We have a lot of Scandinavian teams in Iditarod, but I can't recall the last one that was coming in from Denmark. So it is looking really, really good. And I tend to focus on what the male female ratio is a lot, because I'm always intrigued by the fact that dog sledding is one of the few sports where men and women compete on a level playing field. And it looks like we have just about 10 out of the 41 mushers who entered are female. We've also seen like a bunch of names that are going to be very familiar to people who've been following the race for a long time, like Ryan Reddington, Ramey Smith, Jason Campo, Aaron Burmeister, Ali Zirkel, Mitch Seavey, Martin Boozer. Oddly enough, no Jeff King, or at least no Jeff King yet. Your Olsom, Richie Deal, Jesse Royer, Nick Tedet, Wade Mars, Jim Lanier, who is back again, Travis Beals, the Reddington twins, Karin Hendrickson, who fans might remember was injured when she was on a training run, I believe in the fall, and was hit by a car that had gone off of the road and had gone into the sort of ditch area where she was running with her dogs. And had a very, very badly injured back. So I'm very excited that she is back and that she is hopefully well enough to compete this year. So that's very exciting. Lance Mackey is back this year. Lance won Most Inspirational Musher last year, and people might recall that even though he had said that last year was his final year, that the Most Inspirational Musher comes with a free entry to Iditarod. So Lance is taking advantage of that, and it looks like he'll be running again. So there's a lot of exciting names on this list so far. I should also mention Fabio Berlusconi from Italy is entered as a rookie. And I can't recall, I'm sure there have been other teams from Italy, but I can't recall any. So certainly the first Italian team in a long time running Iditarod. And there's just a lot of, it seems like last year there was not as much excitement about the picnic and about people entering, and it seemed a little bit lackluster, and the numbers really reflected that. But this year it seems like, even if we're not totally back to the level we were at a few years ago, we're well on our way. So as a fan, and as someone who is sometimes very concerned with the long-term sustainability of this race, having 40 people sign up at the picnic, it makes me very, very happy.
Well, I agree with you for sure, and I'm looking here at the list as well, and I see a lot of names on here that I have never seen before, and I don't know if they're rookies or they haven't ran in a very long time, but it's going to be exciting. I'd love to see this, and it reminds me a lot of fantasy football in other sports, where you sit around and you pick your teams well before the first game, and you're kind of jockeying to see who's going to do well and who are the preseason favorites and all of that. And I'm always excited to see what's happening. And of course, as we always do on these shows, as we work our way closer to Iditarod, we always like to put in our top five favorites and who do we think is going to win. And I think just about every year since you and I have been doing this, we've been wrong every year, haven't we?
I have definitely been wrong. I think you probably are more right than I am, but I am always wrong with my predictions, to the point where it's almost a point of pride to be wrong. But, you know, you were saying there's a lot of unfamiliar names, and I'm just looking at the list. There's a lot of people who are in your neighborhood, it looks like, a lot of newer teams that are at least listed as being in Willow or staying in Willow. So I imagine that as it gets towards the fall and winter, you're going to be seeing a lot of these people out on the trails and perhaps getting to know some of these new teams, that some of these new mushers and new teams that are coming up. And that's kind of an exciting thing every year to see, like, the new people and to get a sense of you know, what they're like and what they might bring to the race.
I love doing that. And to speak of that, just a couple of weeks ago, I did an interview with Matthew Failer, and it was our first time getting a chance to talk. We've seen each other on the trails many, many times, but almost always it's either passing in the night or passing with a dog team. And, you know, it's just one of those things where we're yelling on by to the dogs and, you know, we give a nod to each other, but it's always good to be able to talk to your neighbors and really put a voice to the face. And that's interesting with mushing, because often we only know each other by what we can see behind the hood of a parka. And I know that you've been down that road before, and it's difficult to really put faces with names with this sport, isn't it?
It really is. But the flip side of that is that, you know, a lot of times, even though most of us do not think of ourselves as being prejudiced or as having preconceived notions about people, but when you really don't have a sense of this, of the person based on what they look like, and you're just evaluating them based on what they do and how they are with their dogs, that seems like it's kind of a wonderfully pure way to get to know someone. You know, we talk a lot about how people who compete in this sport are brag about being all about the dogs. And in a sense, it's great to be able to get to know people just based on how they are with their dogs and how you see them interact with their dogs on the trail, and you know, what their dogs are like, and when you're at, you know, when you're stopped or when you're when they're being snacked or whatever. So in a sense, I think that's kind of a good thing. But as you said, it's always great to be able to get to talk to these people and get to know them and get to know what their take on life and on mushing is, because you learn so much about their philosophy when you just sit down and talk to them.
You made a great point about not knowing whom they are. And again, to draw another parallel to football, some of the old school college football teams like Notre Dame and Penn State and others, they don't put the names of the players on the back of the jerseys for that very reason. They don't want one person to stand out over the other. So you may know who the quarterback is by him being number 7 or whatever, but you don't really know who he is by name, because of course they don't have numbers or names on their jerseys. And I think that's very similar to the point you're trying to make.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's always exciting to see, like, every year there's one or two new people, either people who are rookies or people who even are veterans, but perhaps have not really made that big an impact before, who sort of, you know, distinguish themselves and become the top stories in the Iditarod. And it, as a fan, it's always great for me to look forward to try to guess who that might be and see that as it progresses.
So, Alex, we had talked about the Iditarod signups and picnic as being the sort of launch to the Iditarod season. And on that day, on that afternoon, they had a pretty major announcement in terms of the race organizing body or sort of the board of the race. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so the Iditarod announced, I believe, the morning of the picnic, that Rob Urbach, and we talked a little bit beforehand, and we decided that's how his name is pronounced. If we're wrong, please let us know. That Rob Urbach was named as the new CEO of the Iditarod Trail Committee. And he officially starts on July 29th, but he will be the guy in charge of it. And previously, he was the CEO of USA Triathlon. He is a triathlete, was a top executive at a global sports management and marketing firm before that, and is someone who has an MBA from Wharton School of Business. So this is kind of exciting to me, because what this says to me is here is someone who is going to come in and is going to be focused on getting the Iditarod to the next level and really looking at a lot of the marketing and promotion opportunities that maybe haven't been looked at in as much depth before. We talk a lot about how the challenges of running an organization like the ITC, and, you know, frankly, in the past, there's been a little bit of a circling of the wagons of the ITC. There's been the attitude that this is an organization for the people who run the Iditarod and should be run and governed by people who are Iditarod veterans and who have, you know, who were in many cases involved with the race for many, many years. And while there's value to that, I think there's also value to having someone come in who can bring a little bit of an outsider's eye to this organization and really maybe look at some outside the box solutions that will really help the Iditarod. And I know that there had been some concern with Dallas Seavey and some other prominent mushers about the old leadership of the ITC and about the board. And I imagine that this appointment will help with that and hopefully maybe bring some of those people who had been, you know, absent from Iditarod back into the fold.
I'm excited about this announcement because I think it does help on both sides, both the mushing side of it, actually kind of a three-pronged approach, the mushing side, the logistics and organizational side, and of course the fan side. And I just want to read a little bit from the press release about the announcement of Rob Urbach. It says, at USA Triathlon, the largest multi-sport organization in the world with more than 500,000 members and 4,300 local events each year, he, meaning Rob, has led the development of a weekly television show, the launch of the USA Triathlon Foundation, and the rollout of an NCAA program. So I think he knows what's happening, at least on a large scale, when you're dealing with something like this. And I know that a triathlon is nothing like the Iditarod in terms of mere distance alone, but just the logistics of putting on a multi-sport race like an Ironman, where, you know, people from all over the world are coming in, and, you know, it's a three-sport event, and everybody's kind of all over the place with tons of volunteers, and it covers many, many miles because they're riding bikes for 112 miles and running marathons and whatnot. I think that this can really help out. And the only thing I'm really curious about is how hands-on he's going to be, or is he just going to be sort of the boardroom CEO? I hope not. What do you think?
Yeah, I'm not sure about that either. But I, you know, the part of the press release that you read is like exactly the right focus for this, because it shows that he can lead an organization that has a lot of individual members who feel involved and who feel like they are stakeholders in the organization and the event, and that there were so many local events that were part of this larger thing. And although the ITC doesn't put on the smaller races, the sprint races and the mid-distance races, that those are vital parts of people being able to qualify and run the Iditarod. So having experience with that is great. And, you know, of course, the development of a weekly television show, certainly having a greater media presence for Iditarod on an ongoing basis would be very, very helpful, both for making sure that the ITC is sustainable long term, and, you know, frankly, helping to raise the profile of this sport and to push back against some of the ill-informed animal rights organizations, which I think have damaged the sport in the past few years based on information that is either incomplete or in some cases flat out wrong.
Yeah, I'm interested to see what develops with this. Alex, we have about 5 minutes left. I have one other comment to make, and maybe you do as well. But I know last year during Iditarod, we had one story that was sort of prevalent throughout the race, and that was the story of the Ugly Dogs and Blair Braverman. And it was interesting to see that she had not signed up yet. And I know that she has been very busy in the off season. Right after Iditarod, she was on a television show on Discovery Channel called Naked and Afraid, and her kennel partner and husband, Quince Mountain, also qualified for Iditarod during the off season, and he was also on that show, and that really started a big buzz on Twitter in particular. But what do you think from the Ugly Dogs camp? Where do we stand right now? Do you have any inside information?
I don't have any inside information. I have a sense that one or both of them would love to run the Iditarod in 2020. I don't know what their plans are or whether that will happen. I was a little bit surprised that they were not there at the picnic, and I really half expected for Blair to sign up again. I know that they have both been extremely busy with a lot of things since the race. But it's, you know, we have a ways to go before the sign up period, before the regular sign up period is closed. So, it would not surprise me to see at least one of them running Iditarod this year. I should mention also, I guess that it seems unlikely that they would both run just because their kennel is a little bit small, but I guess that is still a possibility.
And I know that they spent the year last year up here off the Denali Highway for training, and they lived up there during the training season and during the off season. I know they moved back down south. I believe they're from Wisconsin. But I guess another part of this story is the Ugly Dogs story on Twitter in particular. I know you're much more active on that social media than I am. What is the hubbub with that group? I mean, they were so active and such a force during last year's Iditarod. And I say this because you and I haven't done a lot of shows yet this year since the end of Iditarod. And it's kind of our homecoming, if you will, for our shows here on Mushing Radio. Can you give us any update about sort of the buzz with the Ugly Dogs crew on Twitter?
They were very active in terms of following both Blair and Quince on the Discovery Channel show Naked and Afraid, and you know they are sort of continuing to try to be a force for good in the world, and I guess that a lot of them, like us, are sort of sitting around wondering, well, what exactly are Blair and Quince going to do next year? And as you said, it's a big, big endeavor to move up to Alaska for 6 or 7 months and to, you know, uproot everything in order to pursue this. And, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if it might take a little while for them to decide what they want to do and exactly how they want to do it.
Interesting to see for sure. Alex, do you have any other news that you would like to mention?
You know, just that it is exciting to see people sign up for the Iditarod. There's a lot of stuff on the Iditarod Trail Committee's Facebook page about the picnic, so people might want to check that out. The among other things, the picnic is to celebrate the Iditarod volunteers. So there's always a lot of volunteers who come to the picnic, and it gives them a chance to be up close and personal with the mushers who come and who sign up. And it's also the picnic is at the tail end, so to speak, of the Iditarod Educational Summer Conference, which is for teachers. And I believe that the teachers who come, one of the teachers who is in the summer camp will be selected as the teacher on the trail for next year, although I'm not entirely sure how that selection process works. But it's a big chance for lots of people to get together and celebrate mushers and dogs and dog mushing.
Right. And if you don't mind, Alex, I want to dedicate this show to my mom, Donna. She passed away unexpectedly and suddenly yesterday, July 2nd. We're recording July 3rd, 2019 here on the show. And of course, our moms all have pivotal roles in our lives. And it's tough when they pass away without having the opportunity to say goodbye. And I just want to make sure that I give her a little bit of a dedication here on our show and kind of that public platform that we have. I'm going to be flying down to North Carolina tonight and meeting with family and doing all of that. And I just want to say I love you, Mom, and thanks for everything you did for me.
Well said.
Thank you. Alex, been good. It's been nice having you back on the air for sure. I really love having you on as a co-host, and I can't wait to see what the season brings for us. Like you said, we're about 248 days, I guess it says here on Iditarod.com. Until the big race, it's going to be an exciting off-season and, of course, training as well as we work our way into it. So on behalf of my co-host, Alex Stein, this is Robert Forto for Mushing Radio. We will see you guys next time. Goodbye. All right, Alex, you still there?